Chapter 20. Leadership Lesson 4. Friends Matter. To Win or to Serve. At some point in the early 1990s, Newt Gingrich, Republican representative from Georgia's 6th Congressional District, frustrated that the Democratic Party had control of the House for decades, decided it was time to give the Republicans a shot at power and take the majority. The trouble was, he was tinkering with a system that wasn't really broken. The two parties actually worked quite well together. Though the Democrats had the majority in Congress, unlike today, the primary goal wasn't to brag about who had control. It was to brag about who got things done. Knowing that whoever had the majority still needed the other party, the Democrats didn't take full credit every time something was accomplished. Efforts were made behind the scenes to allow both parties to claim victories and appeal to their respective bases. Election after election, the Democrats kept the majority by default, not because they were better per se. When control was not the primary goal, things got accomplished and both parties were able to get their needs met by working together. It was also common practice at the time for members of Congress, once elected, to move their families to Washington, D.C., returning to their home district offices as often as the congressional schedule permitted. In Washington, they existed in a small world in which their families went to the same churches and schools, regardless of their party affiliations. Democrats and Republicans would argue, debate, and criticize each other in committee by day, and then attend the same school events, backyard barbecues, and cocktail parties at night. Despite their differences, relationships formed, as did the ability to trust and cooperate with each other. Charles Gibson, former news anchor and fellow at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government, recounts how George McGovern, Democratic senator from South Dakota, and Bob Dole, Republican senator from Kansas, would both take to the floor of the Senate and rail against each other's policies, then be seen behaving as the best of friends later the same day. In another example, Tip O'Neill, the outspoken Democratic Speaker of the House, had regular meetings with Republican leader Bob Michael. They worked together. As Reagan's tax cuts were being debated in the early 1980s, Gibson recalls that O'Neill told Congress, "The president has no concern, no regard, no care for the little man in the country." In response, President Reagan accused O'Neill of sheer demagoguery. Later, when the president called O'Neill to smooth the waters, O'Neill is said to have replied, "Old buddy, that's politics. After 6 o'clock we can be friends, but before 6, it's politics." These days, the politics seem to last all day and all night, leaving little time for the friendships. And so it was. Members of opposite parties bridged the gap by forging friendships that gave them perspective. They felt a sense of common purpose. Though divisions had always existed in Washington, for most of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, Congress functioned. Democrats and Republicans had, for the most part, figured out how to cooperate, which, as our biology and anthropology help us understand, happens most effectively when we physically work together and get to know each other. Gingrich, a man who seemed more obsessed with winning than anything else, would set Congress on a new course, however. Cooperation was out. The new goal was control. The strategy he chose was to tear apart the existing system. To disrupt the status quo, he worked to portray a system so corrupt that only a complete overhaul could save it. And in 1994, he succeeded. The Republican Party took control of the House with Gingrich at the helm as Speaker, and the hope for any cooperation between parties was over. Once in charge, Gingrich promoted a whole range of changes that completely altered the way things were done in Washington. And it started with more fundraising. One of the changes included the idea that House members should spend the majority of their time in their home districts, not in the Capitol. In the 1980s, nearly two-thirds of members of Congress lived in Washington, D.C. Today, you'd be hard-pressed to find more than a handful. Instead, members fly into Washington for a short work week, arriving at Congress on Tuesday and returning to their home states on Thursday evening. The result marks a major shift in relations between Democrats and Republicans. Spending most of the week away from where the work is, in order to fundraise, members of the two parties now even have less opportunity to talk to each other, and they certainly don't socialize together as routinely as previous generations of legislators. And with that, there is little opportunity to develop trust. Of course, there were many forces at play that led to the deeply divided Congress we have today, and Gingrich's ascendancy was just one of them. Redistricting and highly politicized media programming contribute to the polarization, as has over-reliance on the internet. Why work face-to-face in Washington when you can send an email from anywhere? Members of Congress have gone from sharing power to hoarding it. With no single guiding vision or purpose, we've moved from governing as a selfless pursuit to governing for selfish gain. Just as business moved from serving the customer to serving the shareholder, Congress went from a culture of cooperation to a battle of wills. All leaders, in order to truly lead, need to walk the halls and spend time with the people they serve. Eyeball leadership, as the Marines call it. The same goes for our elected officials. Yet that's not what's happening. Today, members of Congress say they're spending more time in their home districts in order to better serve their constituents. But they don't actually serve them by doing this. There's little evidence that when back in their home states, our elected representatives are visiting factories or working with citizens to better understand their needs, except perhaps during an election season. What they seem to be doing more of when they return home is fundraising to help ensure their re-election. When we are disconnected from the people with whom we work, we spend more time focused on our own needs than the needs of the people for whom we're supposed to be responsible. In a PowerPoint presentation shown to newly elected Democratic members of Congress, the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, recommends a model schedule while members are in Washington. 4 hours spent making fundraising calls, 1 to 2 hours for constituent visits, 2 hours for work on the floor or in committee, 1 hour for strategic outreach, breakfast, meet and greets in the press, and 1 hour for recharge time. In fact, Tom Perriello, who served in Congress for one term, told the Huffington Post that the 4 hours allocated to fundraising may even be lowballing the figure so as not to scare the new members too much. Regardless of whether or not the members uphold the model schedule, it is just another example of the pressure to make the numbers, win elections, and stay in power instead of building relationships, finding common ground, and making progress for the common welfare. Like the CEO of a public company who cares more about winning and numbers than they do about the people who are doing the actual work, so too have our elected officials got their priorities backward. It is not a surprise that the relationships in Congress today are in a shambles. Hostilities between the parties are at an all-time high. Veteran congressmen recount anecdotally that in the past, about 80% of the debate about a new bill would happen behind closed doors in committee, and 20% on the floor for the camera. These days, party leadership takes debates to the floor before attempting to get consensus in committee first. Olympia Snow, the Republican senator from Maine who served for 33 years, decided in 2012 not to stand for re-election, even though she was the easy favorite to win. In a statement given by Snow and reported by one of her hometown papers, she explained, "I have had to consider how productive an additional term would be. Unfortunately, I do not realistically expect the partisanship of recent years in the Senate to change over the short term. So at this stage of my tenure in public service, I have concluded that I am not prepared to commit myself to an additional 6 years in the Senate." Snow is just one of a growing number of people who, after devoting their lives to public service, are now leaving due to frustration with the caustic environment. If the good guys are leaving, that means that the future of our government is in the hands of the ones who either benefit from the current system or have the stomach to endure the excessive fundraising, increasing short-sightedness, and growing culture of self before service. The result of such an aggressive atmosphere in our government is, as we would expect, a lack of trust and progress. A Gallup poll in January 2013 showed that the U.S. Congress had an approval rating among Americans of only 14%. That's lower than the approval rating of used car salesmen or even Genghis Khan, the 12th century Mongolian emperor infamous for his slaughter of as many as 40 million people, most of them innocent civilians. It is not surprising that 3/4 of Americans, the poll shows, believe that the way politics works in Washington is harmful to the country. And based on all we know about the conditions necessary for trust, cooperation, and progress to exist, they'd be right. If, as social animals, we are most productive when we trust and cooperate, then a lack of trust and cooperation means less will get done. Congress is now considered largely ineffective as a governing body. At the time this book was written, the 112th Congress, the Congress that served from January 3, 2011 until January 3, 2013, was considered the most polarized Congress in history. It passed fewer laws than any time since the 1940s, only 220. The Congress before that passed 383 bills into law, and the Congress before that passed 460. If we accept that passing laws is a legitimate metric of cooperation, even the Congress that previously held the record of least productive, the 104th Congress from 1995 to 1996, was more cooperative with the 333 bills they passed into law, over 100 more than the 112th. The disregard for the human element of governing shows a steady downward trend in the ability of Congress to get anything done, and the effects of this are dramatic. According to political observers, the public largely blames the inability of members of Congress to work together for the economic crisis of 2008. A polarized Congress has been blamed for a lack of progress on the deficit, on reforming Social Security, and on dealing with climate change, among a host of other things. Some current members blame the system, or the speed with which news is able to spread in a wired world, for their struggles and low approval ratings. However, they ignore the fact that they are the system, and the internet doesn't do them harm, it simply reports on the harm they do. The problem is not politics, money, or the media. They are symptoms of the problem. The reason our Congress is as ineffective as it is just a matter of biology. The members of Congress don't spend any time together. If they don't get to know each other and the people they represent, the flow of the social chemicals is limited, and the drive to raise money and win elections makes dopamine their primary incentive. The environment in which our legislators now work makes it difficult for them to trust each other or work together for the benefit of anyone but themselves. Enemies fight, friends cooperate. The members of Congress from the House Agriculture Committee were in Romania as part of a tour to learn more about trade policy and meet some of their European counterparts. It was only by chance that Bob Goodlatte, the long-serving Republican congressman from Virginia, and Stephanie Herseth Sandlin, a junior Democratic congresswoman from South Dakota, found themselves the only two people from the delegation with nothing to do after a day of meetings. And so, they decided to do some souvenir shopping together. Despite serving on the same committee, the two representatives served different parties, and by the unwritten rules of Congress, that meant they were adversaries. Until that day, their relationship could have been described as cordial at best. There is something about getting together out of context that makes us more open to getting to know someone. Whether we're bonding with colleagues with whom we play on the company softball team, out to lunch or on a business trip with someone we don't know well, when the responsibilities of our jobs are not forcing us to work together, when our competing interests are put aside for a while, we seem to be quite open to seeing others as people rather than co-workers or competitors. This may be one of the reasons peace talks so often happen in serene environments where the two warring parties can go for a walk together. And that's exactly what happened with Representative Herseth Sandlin and Representative Goodlatte. Without the weight of politics or their respective parties breathing down their necks, the two of them went exploring together. The Democrat and the Republican became Steph and Bob. And as it turned out, they really hit it off. Though they disagreed on many things at work, they had a lot in common as regular people. As we all know, it is the things we have in common with people that attract us to each other and are the basis of friendship. By the modern standard, what happened between the two members of Congress with opposing views is almost unheard of. Given how little time members spend in Washington, there is simply less opportunity to get together socially with people they like, let alone to try to form relationships with people they're expected to resent. But on this day in Romania, the seeds of friendship would be planted and later grow into something that would serve both representatives for years to come. With the foundation laid, Representative Herseth Sandlin and Representative Goodlatte continued to get together for meals in Washington with no other reason than they enjoyed each other's company. They started to see and treat each other as human beings instead of adversaries. Like any two warring parties that eventually make peace, The two representatives learned that what they had in common was the basis of the trust they needed to talk about the things about which they disagreed. "We paid attention to each other," Herseth Sandlin recounted. "We listened to each other, and we compromised on bills we might not have otherwise." Goodlatte and Herseth Sandlin still voted in opposition to each other more often than not. They didn't always see eye to eye on legislation, but they didn't need to. It was because of mutual respect and friendship that occasions arose when they agreed to do the right thing, even if it meant one of them would have to vote against the party line, which, unlike in a parliamentary system, is technically what we elect our representatives to do in America. Representative Goodlatte even voted for an amendment sponsored by Herseth Sandlin, much to the disappointment of GOP leadership, she said. That rarely happens these days. It's worth noting that when Olympia Snowe voted to allow more debate on the subject of health care reform, her own party lambasted her publicly and threatened to pull her funding just because she voted to continue to talk about it. Cooperation doesn't mean agreement. It means working together to advance the greater good, to serve those who rely on our protection, not to rack up wins to serve the party or ourselves. What the two members of Congress built was a genuine appreciation and respect for each other. What they formed was nothing more than what we in the world outside of politics would call a friendship. That such a relationship should be considered extraordinary enough to serve as fodder for a book is somewhat disturbing. Getting to know the people with whom we work every day seems like it should be the normal way of doing things. A few years before Goodlatte and Herseth Sandlin's experiment, a few forward-thinking members of Congress tried to do the same thing. Recognizing the caustic, relationship-lacking environment that consumes Washington politics, they called for a series of retreats with the aim of encouraging greater civility in Congress. The first one was held in Hershey, Pennsylvania, and Dr. William Urey, world-renowned peace negotiator and co-author of the book Getting to Yes, was there. He recalls several representatives telling him the same thing about the quality of the relationships in Congress. They had spent more time with members of the other party during those 3 days than they had in their entire careers, Urey recounted. Sadly, the retreats were soon canceled due to lack of interest. It turns out that friendship and trust can't be built over 3 days. It takes a regular commitment of, no big surprise here, time and energy. If there is conflict, without knowing each other, it's very hard to make peace, says Urey. And Urey knows a thing or two about peace. Founder of the Harvard Negotiation Project, he is widely seen as one of the leading authorities on negotiating. He is often called upon to help negotiate peace deals among adversaries in various parts of the world. We need them to understand each other, he says, to humanize each other, and to listen to each other. Few would argue with Urey's sentiments. We know that for there to be peace between Israel and Palestine, the leaders must meet. They must talk. We know that for there to be peace between India and Pakistan, they must be willing to come to the table and to talk and to listen. And when the parties refuse to talk, refuse to listen, refuse to even meet, then the odds are high that the conflict will only continue. How can our Congress have the credibility to tell the world how to make peace when they seem incapable of demonstrating how it's done? Herseth Sandlin and Goodlatte are a model of what could be. If the system will not allow for one party to socialize with the other party, hope lies with the individual senators and representatives who have the courage to lead. If they are driven by the desire to serve their constituents and the country, then investing time and energy simply to get to know each other is essential. If, however, they are driven primarily by the desire to win elections and keep their party in power, then the current system is working just fine. For them, not for anyone else. Without retreats or formal engagements, all that is required is for a few progress-minded members in one party to personally reach out to a few progress-minded members of the other party to meet for a drink or a bite to eat with no agenda. If they care about the American people, it is anthropologically necessary for them to get together for no other reason than to get to know each other. Like any relationship, some will get along and some won't. But in time, cooperation will happen.